seen in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will be hearing from the author of a deeply personal and poignant memoir called The Maps They Gave Us in part one of today's program. In part two, we're scheduled to be previewing for you an exciting St. Patrick's Day concert coming up this Sunday afternoon by the Bell City Brass Works. Here's part one of today's program. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with a very talented writer by the name of Wayne Scott, whose essays and articles have appeared in all kinds of places, including the Huffington Post and the New York Times. It was an essay, actually, for the New York Times titled Two Open Marriages in One Small Room that perhaps laid the groundwork for his extraordinary memoir called The Maps They Gave Us, One Marriage Reimagined. In this book, Wayne Scott, with disarming honesty, tells us about his marriage to his wife, Ava, an unconventional marriage in a number of different ways, but chiefly, I suppose, in the fact that it was a mixed orientation marriage, if you will, that Wayne Scott describes as Will and Grace with kids, cats, and a mortgage. And it is the story of how they met, how they fell in love, how they decided to be married, and then the ways in which that marriage became something of a struggle. And it's also the story of their efforts at the urging of a therapist to find a common story, that is, a common understanding of what they had experienced and a common understanding of the nature of their love for one another. And all of that and more is told in this remarkable book published by Black Lawrence Press, again titled The Maps They Gave Us, One Marriage Reimagined. Wayne Scott, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I really, really loved your book. I found it to be just absolutely incredible, and it seems to be such an incredibly honest and open telling of a story that is complicated and, of course, at many times deeply painful. Towards the very beginning of the book, you say, all storytelling draws on imagination and emotions, which have their own kind of truth and their own kind of imperfection, and I draw on both freely to recreate episodes in my life where memory alone would not have been enough. I wonder if you could kind of elaborate on what you are saying there, because you're describing something really important about the book itself and the way you are telling this story.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the interesting thing about creative nonfiction and memoir in particular is that, you're not doing a documentary. You know, you don't have live footage of the things that are happening. You're recreating them through your memories, right? And so it is imperfect. It's art. You know, it's art. And so the characters on the page, they are very much filtered through the dynamics of our relationship, through my imperfect recall of events and things like that. So I actually, both my wife and my three kids, and actually most of the characters in the book, I gave them different names because they really are, they really, at a certain point, they become characters. They are not 100% accurate to the people that are in my life.
You describe yourself at one point as an odd man who knows nothing about basketball or car parts or beer.
And, it's true. Yeah. And house repairs,
Right. You are someone who is a gay man, but who has also had great love and affection for women. And it is out of this kind of stew of different feelings and affections that that you eventually meet the woman whom you would eventually marry, Ava.
Yeah.
But that encounter and your desire for her came in the wake of something quite traumatic that you experienced as a gay man, tied to the AIDS crisis and a terrifying health scare of yours. Briefly describe what I'm talking about to our listeners, and then to what extent you think that had a significant bearing on what then ultimately unfolded with you and Ava.
Yeah, we met in the 80s, at the darkest period of the AIDS pandemic. If you looked at me at that time, from a modern lens, you would say, you know, Wayne is bisexual. You know, he has relationships with men and women. But that word bisexual, it didn't really exist in the same way that it does today. It was actually sometimes a very pejorative term. There was a lot of stigma attached to it because bisexuals in that era were seen as the people who were going to bring the virus to the straight population. And so anyone who identified as bisexual would be hesitant to be too open about that because it was a stigmatized identity. I did identify more as bisexual than as gay. The term queer, in its kind of inclusive and all-encompassing manifestation today, it didn't exist back then. It was still a bad word for gay people. But you know, like I would like now these days, I would refer to myself as queer, a queer man in a straight relationship.
Describe what you found most intriguing about Ava, who was an ardent feminist, intelligent, and interesting in many, many different ways. But describe what your attraction was to her, even beyond that.
Yeah, well, you gave a good introduction of what she's like, and we've been married now 32 years, and when I first met her, I don't even know if I could give you words to describe what I felt because it was so visceral. Like, I really felt, when I first saw her, I really felt like I had been physically knocked over. I did not understand whatever impact she had on me. It actually took me quite a while to figure out, oh, I think this is just attraction. This is just really powerful attraction, and I've just never felt like this towards anyone, man or woman, before. I was surprised, and I loved the sense of surprise. That's the thing about love, is it can surprise us in the journey it takes us on.
Well, and that's one of the things that I think you do a wonderful job of describing, is that it seems like this was a situation in which you came to a new and profound understanding about what a relationship could be. And I suppose, yeah, you know, maybe we're talking about that in contrast to most of the relationships and or the hookups that had been a part of your life. At one point, you write these really beautiful words. It had never occurred to me that the gentleness of two humans touching could be an antidote to the two rough realities of the world, that the endurance of a bond could be part of that comfort, that I wanted this thing called tenderness, which was so lacking with my boyfriends. I'm not even positive at that point you're talking about Ava. I think you might be talking about her friend Naomi. But certainly it points the way towards ultimately what was going to be so important about your relationship with the woman you would ultimately marry.
Yeah, you know that. I'm so glad you read that. That observation came when I was reading a beautiful series of love poems that the lesbian poet Adrian Rich wrote about her. The beginning of her relationship with her lifelong partner. It was in The Dream of a Common Language. And that's actually where the title of the book comes from, the maps they gave us, the short passage from Adrian Rich's, "Whatever we do together is pure invention." the maps they gave us were out of date by year. And that was kind of the inspiration for moving into this kind of like creative, untraditional relationship.
We're speaking with Wayne Scott, talking about his marvelous memoir, The Maps They Gave Us, One Marriage Reimagined. It is the breathtakingly honest chronicle of his marriage to his wife, Ava. You tell us that as things became serious between you and Ava, your shared mantra was no marriage, no kids. In other words,
yeah.
You both had a certain idea about the essential nature of your relationship, your connection, and where, at least at that point in time, you adamantly believed it would not and should not go. Explain what was behind that, and then what changed that?
Yeah, I think marriage, I mean, this is in our 20s, you know, when we were living together 5 years, and marriage had never been part of the story we told ourselves about who we were. Me, because, you know, I identified as queer, and at that time, queer people couldn't get married. And her, because she was a strong feminist, and she questioned how conventional marriage served women's interests. But, you know, the thing is, we also come from families, and we wanted to move far away for me to go to grad school, and I wanted her to come with me. And her father was a very traditional first-generation German guy, and he really would not feel comfortable having his unmarried daughter follow an unemployed MFA student 700 miles away without some promise of, you know, a promise of commitment that was in terms that he could understand, like a conventional marriage. So, you know, and she loved her father. Feminist as she was, she loved her father, and she wanted him to feel comfortable about what we were doing. I did too. So that was actually what led us to go against our mantra and decide, you know what, we're going to get married so that people understand that we have a strong commitment to each other.
Do I remember that you, in a sense, became privately engaged to one another for a period of, I think it was 30 days, and wanted to kind of refer to each other in those terms, and then if you didn't come to sort of loathe the idea, only then would you share it with the rest of the world. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, very good memory. Yeah, we privately described ourselves as engaged to each other for a month, and we would refer to each other as fiancés to see if we could tolerate going against our mantra to be able to do this, to make this movement toward that conventional marriage, and, you know, and ultimately decided that, yeah, we could do it.
It's so interesting to read what you describe in terms of what most people have for their weddings, and what especially Ava was not interested in. She did not want flowers. She adamantly did not want an engagement ring telling you, I'm not a piece of property that needs to be marked. You describe your premarital counseling during it. At one point, the question came up from the priest counseling you, so what about fidelity? Which, of course, raised kind of an interesting issue. I wish we had time to go into it. I want you to just briefly describe the sort of catastrophic misunderstanding that occurred the day of your wedding. It is one of the most amazing scenes I can ever remember reading about in the annals of weddings in human history.
Yeah, very funny in retrospect, you know, from this perspective, but when on the day it happened, quite traumatic. We were locked out of the church on our wedding day. We arrived in all our finery, her in her dress, me dressed to the nines, and saw that all of our guests and the musicians and the flowers and the minister were on the lawn of the church. The people who were opening the church, they'd gotten the time wrong. And I remember, you know, in my groom's outfit, you know, shaking the bars of the door, trying to get somebody to notice that we needed to get in there so we could get married, but it never opened. I went to the minister and I whispered in his ear something no minister ever wants to hear on the day of the wedding. Do you know any place where we could go to get married? And we actually ended up walking a few blocks away to the place where we were going to have the reception, and we got married outside in a beautiful garden on a hot day in Chicago.
And thus ensues a marriage that in many respects, is a happy one, and yet it's fair to say a complicated one. And the dynamic between you, of course, was uncommon. Actually, very early in your relationship with Ava, I think you tell us it was maybe 3 weeks after the two of you had begun sleeping together. She posed to you a very direct question. I need to know what we are to each other. And it occurred to me only after, you know, reading your whole book and following your story, in a sense, through to the end, that in some ways the whole story of this is wrapped up in that question. The question of what she meant to you, what you meant to her, and if you had the same understanding of that.
Yeah. You know, she asked that question, it was just a few weeks after we'd been dating, and it was a surprise to me because up to that point, I had mostly been with queer guys, and they did not talk about monogamy. You know, young queer guys in their 20s did not have a big emphasis on monogamy, even with their boyfriends, at least in my experience, right? So in this experience with dating a woman, it was a surprise to me. But also, I have to say, weirdly, an incredible comfort. I mean, it was a dangerous time. No one had ever promised or asked for monogamy. And my immediate response when she said that was, oh my gosh, I would be so safe. What an incredible, sweet, and loving gesture if we had that kind of safe container with each other to get through this time where, you know, at that time there was no management or treatment for HIV and AIDS. I mean, it was a deadly disease at that time. It was very scary. I had HIV scares up at that point. And so it felt like a very loving gesture when she asked for that.
Hmm. Well, of course, you ultimately do get married. And I think it's fair to say that there is a great deal of happiness. But that happiness at the outset does, in a sense, not continue. It sounds like at one point, one of the factors that created some of the difficulty was when you moved. You tell us at one point in the book, we moved twice and we got farther and farther away from ourselves. Explain what you mean by that and what significance that had in ultimately the difficulties that consumed the two of you.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think like a lot of people in all kinds of long-term partnerships, especially with little kids, it's really easy to feel like you have lost yourself, that you have forgotten who you were, you know, with the demands of domesticity and parenting and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I lost track of that queer part of myself. It felt weird, you know, standing around the sidelines of the soccer game or going to school events. It felt weird to mention that I thought of myself as queer or bisexual, especially in a straight passing relationship. People would wonder, why are you telling me this? You know, what is this about? And so I stopped mentioning it. You know, I stopped mentioning it. I let people assume that I was just a heterosexual dad. And that wasn't true. That wasn't who I was. And I grew lonely and desperate. And I didn't know how to talk about that with Eva because of the way we had taken our vows. It would have almost been akin to asking for a divorce. I didn't know any safe way that I could tell her, I don't think this works for me anymore to be, you know, only straight.
Mm. You write, for years I was straining within the definition of our marriage, hiding my unhappiness, unable to talk about revision. Explain what ultimately happens, what your wife stumbles upon one night while you are out of the house doing your 9 p.m. evening run that causes her angrily to throw you out of the house.
Yeah, well, it you know, requires me to talk about behaviors I'm not proud of, but in my loneliness and my desperation and my inability to talk to her, you know, because of feeling like I would be breaking my vows by even mentioning it, I started reaching out to men through the internet, and we shared access to each other's email accounts And so she needed to look up something related to a bill or something like that, and she saw that I was doing that. And I think at that point, we have had some ups and downs related to this, and she felt like she just had enough. She felt very, very, understandably, felt very, very betrayed. And I felt like I had betrayed her. I knew that I was wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out, what do I do with the fact that I feel like I've done this terrible, wrong thing to my wife, and I also still want to be married.
Mm. You say at one point, in describing yourself, I am a man who is a traitor to his vows. I find that so striking, because I think a lot of times when people are unfaithful, I mean, betray their vows, it's somebody who never particularly cared about their vows or understood the seriousness of their vows, or once did but doesn't anymore. And in talking about this the way you do, we realize that sometimes both things can be true. We can make a vow, that vow can mean a lot to us, and yet somehow that doesn't mean that that mistakes can't be made, or however we want to talk about that. You spend a little bit of time talking about the whole notion of abandonment, and the fact that when your wife, in her insistence that the marriage needed to end and that she was filing for divorce, and it would be for, I suppose, what is called emotional abandonment. And you speak so eloquently about what that term means, to be abandoned or to be the one who has done the abandoning. And it is something you had even experienced painfully in your own life with your father, who was an alcoholic and who, in effect, abandoned you and your brothers.
Right, and my mother, yeah. And that really provided a powerful frame of reference to me, because I knew what it was like as a child to have a parent abandon you. And so even though my spouse and I were going through this incredibly rough time and she was intent on wanting a divorce, I knew from my own experience as a child in a house where there was a divorce that it was painful when the father didn't come home. And so I figured out, I just decided I'm going to figure out a way to get back home. I'm going to figure out a way to be under the same roof, to figure out a way that it can be tolerable for both her and me, because I knew my children would probably want the same thing that I had wanted when I was growing up.
Ultimately, although your book begins in a very painful place, with the two of you meeting with a mediator, and things are just as cold as ice between you, or certainly in terms of the feelings of Ava for you. But that is not the end of the story, not by a long shot. Explain your path forward from there.
Yeah. You know, over time working with the professional we went to see, she did both divorce mediation, but she also did the couples counseling. And after we'd been working with her for, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, she made the observation, you guys don't actually seem like you're interested in getting divorced. You actually seem pretty devoted to each other. Have you ever thought about having an open relationship? And we were both astounded that she could bring that option up to us. I thought she was actually breaking a rule. I thought couples counselors could, I didn't think they could talk about non-monogamy. I thought they always had to operate from a monogamy paradigm. But what Lynae's the therapist, what she said is, you know, couples can make it work if they love each other. You know, there are lots of different ways to be married. I work with other unconventional couples. It takes communication. And yeah, maybe it's a little bit more difficult because there's not the same social support. But if you want to make it work, you can make it work. It's your story. And that was kind of inspiring for us. No professional had ever said, you know, that it's okay to consider this experiment of an open marriage.
What are the ways in which you have managed to make that work? Because, of course, such a thing does not necessarily work under every single circumstance. What do you think have been the keys to making it as successful? That seems like a funny word, but I'm going to use it. To make it as successful for the two of you as it has been.
Yeah, no, definitely successful. We've been together 32 years now, and we've been in this open phase for almost 15. So it has been successful. You know, when you're conventionally married, you know, you get the rules. You either get them from the church or whoever marries you, you know, you get the rules about how you're going to be to each other. When you go down this path of non-monogamy, you have to kind of develop your own rules, your own maps, your own agreements. And so that's what we did. We actually had specific agreements about how we were going to manage having a family, living under the same roof, and having outside kind of romantic connections with other people. And it took a long, it wasn't easy. I don't want to make it seem like it was easy. There was a lot of iteration, you know, a lot of trying things and then revising them. And it was much like you would do with a story, right? You draft and then you revise, you know, kind of make it what you need it to be. But eventually we got to the agreements that allowed us to honor our own relationship, but also honor the unique people we were and our own need to grow.
I think maybe the difference is that some of us who've never even pondered such a thing imagine an open marriage as being no holds barred, throw the rules out the window. And indeed, you did make the decision to shed conventional practice, but that doesn't mean that there aren't rules, or maybe we shouldn't even call them rules, but you've tried to do this thoughtfully and carefully and mindful of each other's feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not prescriptive about this form of marriage at all. You know, I think people need to figure it out on their own, what's gonna work for them. This is just what worked for us and what enabled us to kind of, you know, still be together in relationship, but also be able to, you know, for me to actually be able to be a full person and to grow.
I love how the book ends as the two of you are sitting together on a mountainside, and you say, "Why is it every time we burst onto this view, which we've seen so many times and so many seasons, it surprises us? The world formed this mountain and its rippling image through the happenstance of geologic forces, volcanic explosions, shifting tectonic plates, moving glaciers, avalanches, a rumble of terror leading to this serenity. It has gathered all accidents into this beautiful, almost symmetry. The real thing and its trembling visual echo, shifting, imperfect, in the sky-painted lake." A beautiful picture and a beautiful thought as we conclude reading your book, The Maps They Gave Us, One Marriage Reimagined, published by Black Lawrence Press. Wayne Scott, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for talking about your thought-provoking and illuminating book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is part two of today's program. This wonderful, rollicking piece is called Molly on the Shore. This is an arrangement by Percy Grainger. It is an Irish favorite among many wonderful Irish songs. And that is kind of the theme of what we will talk about in the remaining minutes of today's morning show. Coming up this Sunday afternoon, the day before St. Patrick's Day, the Bell City Brassworks will be continuing its 36th season with a concert called Songs and Dreams, The Music of the Emerald Isle. And it will be a concert, at least largely, composed of Irish music. And we are going to be talking today on the morning show with two representatives of the Bell City Brass Works, who are going to be telling us all about it. First of all, we have Doug Johnson, who is the director of the group, and tell us this amazing woman who is sitting next to you, without whom things just would not stay afloat.
Well, without Katie here, we would have serious problems getting the whole program going. She is our business manager, president of the board, and I'm very happy to have her with us today. We have we're doing a concert, like you said, our 36th year, and it's an Irish themed concert. And I'm just thrilled with the way the band's performing. And the direction that they're going, we play with so many different styles when we're doing this music. And one of the arguments that people have had with brass groups are, they're always so loud. No, they aren't. They aren't. This group can play so soft, so beautiful. And in pieces like one of the pieces that we're doing, which is entitled Far and Away, a John Williams piece, there are many uses of mutes, and we use every mute under the sun while we're playing that piece to get all the different qualities of sound, and it's really an excellent, excellent piece.
So we have a lot to look forward to. So Doug Johnson will be on the podium, and Katie Humphrey, you are in the French horn section.
I am, front row.
All right. Well, that's right where the action is.
Very good.
So I suppose it's kind of a no-brainer because the sort of the realm of Irish music is so rich and wide-ranging, and if you have a concert that falls close to St. Patrick's Day, I mean, why not? Was it on purpose that this concert was scheduled closely to St.
Patrick's Day? Yes, it is. Well, we're usually doing it near this time of the year every year. In fact, last year I think it was an all-Scottish concert, but this year, because we were right on the eve of St. Patrick's Day, it just made absolute sense to do these pieces of music. And the music gives a wide range of Irish music, everything from laughter to tears to beautiful scenery to beautiful thoughts, and again, thoughts and dreams of a beautiful place in the world.
Lovely. Kate Humphrey, tell us a little more about the duties that you have. First of all, what is your official title?
I'm the president of the board. I've been in the band for many years, probably pushing 20 years in the French horn section. I got back into playing with the band actually in 2001, briefly. A person that gave a lot of lessons to the people in our group, Johnny Hemkes. The Brassworks were doing a tribute concert for him, and I could not miss that. At that point, I hadn't played my horn in about 20 years.
Wow.
And so I found a horn, and I got there, and I played horribly, but I was there and really enjoyed being with the group and the camaraderie and the spirit of this wonderful brass group. If you're a brass player, you play in different groups, and you play your role. But when you're in a brass band, that's where your people are.
Yes, they are.
And it's just a different level of musical experience.
Sure.
And when I was able to join, I started with the band. I was still living in East Troy, and I would drive over to play with the group. And people would say, "Well, you're nuts." Well, yeah, but I get to play with the Brassworks. And I've been with them pretty much ever since. I had a brief time when I lived out of state, but it's a fabulous group. There's such incredible musicianship in this group. Very experienced musicians, and they work at it. I mean, this music we're playing is not the kind of thing you pick up and play. This is the kind of stuff you've got to work on. And Doug, I've said this before, but many times he'll present the work that we're going to do, the pieces we're going to do for a particular concert, and we'll play through them. That's what we do right after when we start a new series. We run through everything, and I'll be like, oh boy, you know, is this the time? Like, are we really going to do it? And I have confidence that he's chosen things that we can do, but they're always aspirational.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But because of that, we've matured as a group,
yes,
particularly in the last few years.
Right.
We used to rehearse in church basements, which were wonderful. Those are facilities that were available to us. But we upped our game a few years ago, and we're rehearsing at Parkside. We have use of their band room with their percussion equipment, so our percussionists can be with us the whole time, which really helps our sound, too.
Right.
We used to just get them for a dress rehearsal and play, and it never felt as cohesive.
Sure. Yeah.
And now they've become part of us as,
right,
as a group. There's been something magical that's happened, and we just keep getting better.
Hmm.
And it feels good. A lot of us have been around for a while. I want to say older. But to just have those challenges and keep growing. There was a quote I've seen just on social media and stuff where 97-year-old is asked, why do you keep practicing? Because I'm getting better, you know?
Ah.
And that's exactly what's happening.
And it's a great feeling.
I mean,
it is. There's just no sweeter feeling in the world than...
Yep.
Than working and growing and learning. And
right.
And then being able to perform at the Bedford Theater at Parkside, it's just magic. I mean, we've performed in churches for many years, and there's definitely a place for that, and we're grateful for that. And for our Christmas programs, it's definitely wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But it raises us to another level when we're able to perform in that beautiful theater.
Right.
And our sound is just even more enhanced, mm-hmm, and that theater is acoustically perfect and intimate in the way it's set up, and it's just a joyous place to play.
Yeah.
And we've made ourselves very accessible. We don't charge admission for our concerts. We want to be available to anyone that wants to see us. We ask for a free will offering, and people are generous, and none of our musicians are paid. So we're all volunteers, and the overhead is to cover some of Doug's expenses, although he is almost volunteer. We're not able to compensate him very much, but his dedication is definitely there. He lives in Stoughton, for crying out loud, and he commutes in.
Makes the trip.
Yep.
Yes, I do.
And happily so.
And 5 days this week I'll be doing that.
Wow. You know those roads well, don't you?
Oh, yes.
47 members of the group, at least for this particular concert. And I know one of the things that has always kind of struck me is how many of those musicians are themselves band teachers.
Yes, yes.
Or educators in one way or another. And it's probably good for them to be on the other side of the baton.
It is. It is actually, and it bothers me a little bit for me because I'm on that side of the baton. I'm waving it all the time because I enjoy playing tremendously. But it is a thrill to work with these gentlemen and ladies that have all been music teachers or have been through many different music programs. The brass section that we've got, probably of the brass players we have, I think our brass section fills every other ensemble in the Racine and Kenosha area, every adult ensemble. It's our brass players are belonging in those groups. So it's terrific in that sense that we get a chance to do wonderful music with musicians who want to keep improving. And not everybody's a music teacher. There are some people that played in high school, put it away, and got it back out sometime and joined us, and they have become very strong contributing members to the group.
We're talking about the Bell City Brassworks concert coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. in the beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Conductor Doug Johnson is with us, as is Katie Humphrey, who is in the French horn section and president of the board of directors. So we want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about a few musical highlights for Sunday afternoon's concert. So
there are a few pieces that we're doing. The first piece we open up with in the concert is entitled Irish Dances. Includes four different Irish dances, but there's one in particular in there called The Last Rose of Summer. And it is a beautiful, beautiful piece of music. Flugelhorn soloist on this one is Eric Weiss, who is one of our ultimate musicians in our group, and
just gorgeous sound
that he puts out, and it you'll be thrilled when you listen to that piece. And
I
then
cry a little.
Yeah, okay. And of course, the Galway Piper, for those people that are fans of Irish movies, you will recognize the pieces that come in there. And then another piece we play is an Irish blessing, a piece I hadn't heard before, by Craig Stevens. And it starts with our cornet soloist, Nancy Quist, who is also another ultimate musician here in this area, and I am thrilled to have her with us. She's our principal cornet player in the group, and it's just an excellent, excellent solo. Other things that we're doing, there's an interesting piece called Far and Away, written by John Williams. It was for the movie Far and Away. And I was talking about the mutes and the other sounds that we put there. It starts out in a very mysterious opening to it, and you can feel the fog lifting as you're coming into Ireland. And then it gets to this middle section that just is full of fun and energy and just gorgeous to do. Now, the other thing about this concert that we've got doing is this had been a memorial concert for years. And it was also the solo concert. So what we did was a memorial to Johnny Hempkus at the end by doing a piece for him. And then we also had two or three guest soloists with our group, high school musicians who got scholarships from us. And they perform on the concert with us through this program. Well, as we've gone along, this has become, again, the scholarship concert and somewhat memorial. And so the ending of our concert, Irish Tune from County Derry, is now kind of our signature piece to end the piece. And a wonderful piece of music and just can tear your heartstrings. But our soloists, these high school students that we've got, thank you, schools. Thank you, kids, for your talent, parents, for your kids. These two young ladies that come in to play trombone solos for us, they are fantastic. One is from Bradford High School, and that is Emmeline Erickson, and she's going to be performing a trombone concerto. And then the winner of our contest this year was Leah Weisinger, again, a trombone soloist and fantastic player.
From Tremper.
So we have one from Bradford, one from Tremper, just like my wife and I, one from Bradford, one from Tremper. So.
Very good. So that has to be a special moment, Katie, I should think, when you as a group get to welcome really, really young musicians to the stage to be part of all this.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And their talent is inspirational. Just their energy. And we all kind of think back to our time, of course, at that age and where we were starting with our music. And, it's the full circle moment for sure.
Yeah, even some of these young ladies and gentlemen that have soloed for us have come back to become soloists in our group and stay with us. One in particular on euphonium, Mr. Eric Mertens, was, I think, the first person to win a scholarship with us. And he is playing as our principal euphonium and, again, has fantastic parts and solos in the music, and it's a very wonderful group of people to work with, very on top of music, and really want to show us what they can do. But these young people come and stay with us. Katie Poole, used to be Katie Plavonic, she has played with us for years since she was younger in high school days. So it's great to see them all involved and to continue playing for as many as they can possibly play.
Right. So we are speaking Friday morning, and the concert is on Sunday. You've already been in Francis Bedford?
Oh, yes, we have. Yeah, we did a rehearsal Tuesday night this week, our dress rehearsal, and had a chance to go through all the music. And the acoustics, like Katie said, are fantastic in there. It enhances our sound. It takes advantage of our ability to play soft and our ability to excite the audience in the complexities of music.
Right. And there's not a bad seat in the house, that's for sure.
No.
Yeah, very, very good. So, Katie, explain to our listeners what they should do, exactly where they should go if they want to take in a Sunday afternoon's concert.
So head out to Parkside from whatever direction you're coming from. The beer garden's not open, so you won't get distracted there. So so come on in that end of campus. Come into the Rita, which is Pickens Talent Hall. So you plenty of parking, free parking, easily accessible. There's a drop-off circle. If you've got people that need a little closer walk, you can drop them off. Come on in. Take a right when you get through the doors, and you'll go down a hallway, and the theater's right on your left. You'll get a beautiful program when you walk in the door. You'll find your seat. There is an intermission, so you know you don't have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, the seats are comfy. You'll just have a wonderful experience.
It's a beautiful, beautiful setting, yep. That's for sure. And then we would encourage people to mark the calendars for the concert that ends your current season, right. Which is June 8th.
June 8th, yes. And usually we do this concert at Union Grove, but Union Grove High School this year is having some construction being done around it so that we could not use the building. So again, we're back at Bedford Hall for that, and this is more of a Pops concert. We've done Broadway favorites, we've done musical favorites, we've done movie themes, we've done jazz, all sorts of different genres on this concert, and we'll continue to do that on the one that we're going to be coming up. We're just putting the program together as we speak today.
Lots to look forward to. So people should mark their calendars accordingly for the 8th of June. Yep. But in the meantime, take in this St. Patrick's concert that is coming up this Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
And the Bell City Brass Works, under the direction of Doug Johnson and Katie Humphrey, anchoring the French horn section and president of the board. I'm glad both of you could be here to talk about what promises to be a lovely concert on Sunday afternoon. Best wishes to you and all of your musicians.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg.
All right, and here's a little taste of Danny Boy to take us up to 9 o'clock. The music of Danny Boy, again, will be featured on the Bell City Brass Works concert this coming Sunday afternoon at Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the campus of UW Parkside, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, a concert free and open to the public. Monday on the morning show, my first interview with Tip McGuire, who represents the 64th Assembly District, and we will be talking with him, among other things, about Governor Evers' budget proposal and how it is being received in Madison. That will be Monday on the morning show. Today is going to be partly sunny, windy, and warm. We are actually headed for a high today of 76 degrees inland, a little bit cooler near the lake, and winds up to 35 miles per hour. It will be windy and rainy tonight. Maybe some thunderstorms, in fact. Overnight low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow, Saturday, partly sunny, very windy and warm again. Although tomorrow's high will be just 62 degrees and chillier still on Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.